this one, bro.
It is Thursday, January 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, reports indicate North Korea may be close to launching a ballistic missile.
The most difficult part of any long-range ballistic missile is the re-entry phase. We are not certain that they have actually mastered that process yet, and they have not tested it.
A Swedish human rights activist is deported from China, and a film by a Korean-American director explores the relationship between two women in Love Song. It's all ahead. Media reports suggest North Korea may be just days away from launching a long-range ballistic missile. The Japanese news agency Kyodo cites an unnamed Japanese official who spoke of signs of possible preparations for a missile launch based on analysis of satellite imagery at the North's Tongchang-ri missile site. The cable news network quotes a U.S. official as saying that imagery in recent days has shown the movement of personnel, rocket-related equipment, and fuel. The reports come just weeks after the North conducted its fourth nuclear test, claiming it was its first hydrogen bomb detonation. However, international experts say the test measured as too small to qualify as a full hydrogen bomb test. The reports emerge as the UN Security Council considers possible new sanctions against Pyongyang for its latest test, a violation of previous resolutions. Troy Stangerone with the Washington-based Korea Economic Institute tells International Edition's Victor Beatty, while he doubts North Korea's missile launch capabilities, the assumption has to have been mastered the intricate technology.
We know that they took and conducted a long-range test in 2012 when they put a satellite in orbit. Most U.S. military planners proceed from the assumption that they have mastered the technology and have the ability to take and hit potentially both Guam and the western portion of the United States. That being said, the most difficult part of any long-range ballistic missile is the re-entry phase. We are not certain that they have actually mastered that process yet, and they have not tested it. If you look back at the Cold War, the United States and the Soviet Union tested missiles upwards of 100 times before putting them into operational phases. So at this point, I think it's questionable whether North Korea can actually deliver a long-range payload. But that being said, for the purposes of planning, we have to assume that they have mastered the capability.
How long have they been working on developing such a missile?
They've been working on this for decades now. Their nuclear program goes back to the 50s. And they've been conducting tests on missiles since the 90s.
Do we know anything more about this fourth nuclear test conducted early this month on January 6th?
I think at this point, we're still waiting to get back some of the aerial evidence. The South Koreans thought they detected some xenon particles, but they didn't necessarily go beyond what might be naturally occurring in the atmosphere. But at this point, I think when we look at the type of explosion that took place, the seismic wave that occurred, it's highly unlikely that it was a hydrogen bomb. If there was any hydrogen component, it most likely was an enhanced bomb with tritium, which is a different isotope within hydrogen itself that can be used sometimes to enhance the explosive capability of a more conventional nuclear weapon.
What are analysts saying with regard to how long it will take for North Korea to marry a miniaturized nuclear warhead to a workable ballistic long-range missile?
I think this is one of the things that's difficult at this point to determine. If you look at this from a technical standpoint, because we don't know what the actual test was, if it was tritium that was used to enhance this last test, it means they might have proceeded further along the miniaturization phase. But I mean, this is something that I've seen estimates from 2 to 3 years. It could take longer than that. But without having the specifications in terms of what types of tests they've actually been able to conduct and how that is actually proceeding, have these tests been successful, or were they actually tests that were not completely successful and they're still mastering the technology? It's difficult to say, but most estimates are probably 2 to 3 years, if not longer.
That's Troy Stangerone of the Korean Economic Institute. He says a new North Korean missile launch could push China back what U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says should be significant new U.N. sanctions in the wake of Pyongyang's most recent nuclear test. At a Thursday news briefing, Chinese Foreign Ministry spokeswoman Hua Chunying said the North's nuclear test has increased complicated factors to the current situation on the Korean Peninsula and Northeast Asian region. She said Beijing was paying great attention to the current situation. Japanese and South Korean officials declined to comment on the missile preparation reports. Well, my colleague Susan Yaki joins me now. She's been looking at the web about this story.
Hi, everyone. Well, Sarah, you mentioned the media reports on this possible North Korean missile launch. Beyond the CNN report and word from Kyoto, a Fox News headline reads, North Korea reportedly readying to launch long-range missile. It says a South Korean government official told the Yonhap news agency that steady activity has been observed at the missile site with rails set up to quickly move parts for rocket assembly and eventual launch. The Independent writes, North Korea appears to be preparing to fire a long-range missile, according to a government source in Japan. And there are numerous other news stories with pictures at North Korea missile. The lead story on our website, voanews.com, is developments in Libya. The story by Jeff Selden reads, U.S. military forces are on the ground in Libya looking for potential partners in what could soon be an expanded campaign against the Islamic State terror group. Pentagon Press Secretary Peter Cook told reporters there have been some U.S. forces in Libya trying to establish contact with forces on the ground. Get a better sense of who the players are who might be worthy of U.S. support and support from some of our partners going forward. Cook described the U.S. contingent as a small group, adding they were in Libya at the concurrence of Libyan officials. And trending on Twitter today was Federer. You know about this stuff, Sarah, being a tennis man. Roger Federer is facing off with Novak Djokovic in the 2016 Australian Open semifinal tennis competition. There are a couple of invites to watch the match live online. Meanwhile, Greg Henderson says, love how they reckon Federer is old at 34 years old. Pankaj Advani writes, about time Federer got lucky with the net and lines. Mike Crummy notes that a Federer point was so exciting, it got a, quote, dude out of his wheelchair. And there is a photo of a man rising from his chair. And if you want to get into the action, so to speak, visit Federer on Twitter. Sarah?
Thanks very much, Susan. That's International Edition Susan Yaki. Well, U.S. President Barack Obama has posthumously honored four people who risked their lives to protect Jews during the Holocaust. The ceremony took place on International Holocaust Remembrance Day Wednesday, commemorating the liberation of the Auschwitz concentration camp in southern Poland. Israel confers Righteous Among the Nations medals to non-Jews who helped Jews during the Holocaust. The ceremony took place for the first time in the United States. Zlata Zahok reports other commemorations were held nationwide with major events at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington.
President Obama joined Jewish leaders and Holocaust survivors at the Israeli embassy in Washington for the ceremony honoring Americans Roddy Edmonds of Tennessee and Lois Gunden of Indiana, and Polish citizens Valerie and Marie Lasbiewski.
The Talmud teaches that if a person destroys one life, it is as if they've destroyed an entire world. And if a person saves one life, it is as if they've saved an entire world.
In his speech, Obama said anti-Semitism and intolerance are on the rise again, and he encouraged everyone to stand against such movements. Earlier in the day, the Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington hosted an event honoring the victims of the Holocaust. Holocaust survivors, foreign dignitaries, and other guests lit candles for the victims. Many of the survivors now live in the United States.
I was born in the Netherlands, in Holland, and my life was saved by an Indonesian family living in Holland, actually, and especially their Muslim nanny. I was 9 months old when I was left with his family, and they really risked their lives, you know, to take in a Jewish baby. And that's why I'm able to be here today.
Nessie Godin is a Holocaust survivor from Lithuania.
As a little child from 13 to 17, I lived through a ghetto concentration camp, four labor camps, and a death march. How did I survive? By the grace of the Lord in heaven, but whatever name we call him.
German Ambassador Peter Witting said Germany is aware of its special responsibility to prevent genocide in the future.
We Germans today share your pain and the memory of the unspeakable horror. But most importantly, we share a vision for our common future. Our confrontation with the past is the moral compass that guides our actions so that Jewish citizens can live in peace and security in Europe and everywhere in the world.
Later Wednesday, German, French, and EU ambassadors held a roundtable discussion on combating hate in Europe. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Australian astronomers say they have found the largest solar system ever observed. When they noticed a solitary planet meandering through space, the astronomers wondered if it had a host star or if it were a rogue or starless planet. So, after conducting a search, the astronomers found a red dwarf star that's about 100 light years away, which is the same distance as the planet. The astronomers linked the star with the planet after they studied their motion and noticed they were both moving together. The solitary planet is thought to be a gas giant planet with about 12 to 15 times the mass of Jupiter. Astronomers calculated that the distance between the planet and its star is about 1 trillion kilometers. The planet makes one complete orbit around its star every million years, and its orbit is more than 140 times wider than Pluto's. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, a new film explores a hard-to-define relationship between two women friends. Swedish human rights activist Peter Dahlin has returned to his home country after being deported from China and accused of endangering state security. The 35-year-old Dahlin is the co-founder of Chinese Urgent Action Group, which assists Chinese human rights lawyers with training and other support. He was detained earlier this month and last week was seen on Chinese state television confessing to the allegations. Patrick Poon is China researcher for Amnesty International, and he's based in Hong Kong. He tells me what this means for other human rights workers and members of non-governmental organizations in mainland China.
You can see how it is so alarming for other international human rights workers who are now doing advocacy work, in particular in mainland China, because what we could see Peter's organization in helping would be just like helping human rights activists, human rights lawyers to go through, you know, the legal procedures to help the petitioners or those underprivileged to go through the legal framework within mainland China. So it's really legal for them to help those people. But then, like, the way it is now presented as the way the Chinese government try to present them through the CCTV program, making Peter and, you know, some others also recently to confess in the official national broadcaster, can only see how the government in China is just trying to divert the attention to other allegations that has no reasonable grounds, but try to divert the attention on, you know, trying to make them confess instead of giving them any access to immediate access to lawyers. And in Peter's case, he actually was only given access to consular service because of the visits at the very end of his detention. So, I mean, like, all this actually would have very chilling effect on the national human rights community working in China and also the mainland Chinese civil society as well. The government now is having a very hard line on cracking down on civil society in China, including human rights lawyers and these human rights activists and human rights workers in general.
And in this situation, in Peter Dahlin's situation, he was detained along with his girlfriend, Pan Jinling, who is a Chinese citizen. Is it known her status?
I mean, like what you learn also in seeing public statements made by Peter and also Peter's colleagues is that Peter's girlfriend has been released, but she remains in China. So it's very worrying whether, you know, now she may not be allowed to go anywhere, because it's very unclear about whether she could leave the country or not. And also now she also can't speak much. As we understand, it's difficult for Peter to talk about the case as well, because it's really the case that now they can not talk about the case. Otherwise, there would be some, there may be some kind of revenge. I'm concerned whether it would be put on Peter's girlfriend if they talk too much, because the situation seems to be like that. But as Bobby understands, it's now released, but remains in China.
And that seems to be the pattern with a number of these people who've been arrested or detained, that authorities, they have a relative or close friend, and so they're no doubt concerned about their loved ones.
I mean, like these tactics, we can see it's justified for us to suspect whether, you know, the government in China is using this as a way to silence critics and silence anybody they think they don't like. And so in addition to deporting Peter, and by keeping his girlfriend in mainland China, would also act as a way to keep him silent. And also because the girlfriend is in China, if she would say anything about her detention or about Peter's detention, and then maybe like she herself would also get into further trouble. That is something that is legitimate to ask. So I mean, like, it seems the way that the government is trying to silence them for the time being, it is difficult for them to say anything about what happened in their detention.
Patrick Poon, China researcher for Amnesty International, speaking from Hong Kong about the deportation of Swedish activist Peter Dahlin from China. Well, the wife of a Chinese editor who recently went missing was summoned by Chinese officials for questioning on Tuesday, just hours before she was scheduled to discuss her husband's case live on international television. He Fangmei said Friday she last spoke to her husband, Li Xin, former opinion editor for the liberal-leaning Southern Metropolis Daily, on January 11th, when he was riding a train in Thailand. He agreed to discuss Li's disappearance live on VOA's Mandarin service television. Less than an hour before her scheduled airtime, she was summoned to a local police station. According to a Spanish news service, He's personal cell phone was confiscated during the detention. After being released by Chinese officials, He contacted VOA by email to apologize for her inability to be available for the televised interview. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. A new film from Korean-American director So Young Kim, Love Song, explores the complexities of muted desire between two longtime friends. Here's International Edition's David Byrd.
Sarah, played by Riley Keough, and Mindy, played by Jenna Malone, are longtime friends. Sarah is married to a man who is never home, and they have a daughter. Mindy is a free spirit who seems to know exactly how to coax Sarah out of safety. When Mindy visits Sarah one day, she persuades her friend to take off on a road trip. One gets the sense that there's more than just friendship here, but the feelings between the two women remain subtly subterranean. The film jolts the audience with an abrupt end to the road trip, and then we see the two characters 3 years later when Sarah is attending Mindy's wedding. It is there that Sarah finally confronts her feelings about her friend. If the relationship is not made completely clear, are they friends, are they lovers, are they friends who might want to be lovers, that's on purpose. Director So Young Kim, known for her Korean language films In Between Days and Treeless Mountain, says she wanted to explore the evolving dynamics between the two characters.
I love love stories, and I wanted to explore an area that's kind of unusual, you know, and I wanted to tell dynamics between two friends who are women, and they're not necessarily, you know, one sexual preference or the other, but I just wanted them to explore what their relationship could mean, you know, and then fall in love, fall out of love, and try to navigate that.
Riley Keough, best known for being Elvis Presley's granddaughter, as well as her film work in The Runaways, Magic Mike, and Mad Max Fury Road, says that she enjoys working with Kim, particularly on character-driven stories like Love Song.
No, I worked with her on a short film we did called Spark and Light, and I worked with her husband on this movie, Jack and Diane, and so we've done, and this is the third thing I've done with them, and we're kind of really close, and they like to do things, you know, with people they've worked with before and very intimately and shoot out of their house. And, you know, I stayed in their garage, and that's kind of how I like doing things, and they do too. So it's fun, you know, when you find people that you like working with, you kind of, I think, just keep working with them.
The film is entered in the drama category at the Sundance Film Festival. It comes at a time when Hollywood is facing criticism for a lack of diversity in the Oscar nominees. Jenna Malone says the film industry is reflecting a societal problem, and only when society changes will filmmaking change.
You know, if anything's lacking in the film industry, it's because we're lacking it in society, you know. So it's more like we all have to come together and change before, you know, we can't just kind of put filmmakers up in a some golden box somewhere. You know, they exist because we put them there. You know, we need to tell different kind of stories. We need to evolve as a society, you know, and I think that's more important than being like, oh, we have to embrace all things female. It's like, no, we have to embrace all things human. And once we do that, it's not going to matter whether it's man or woman or black or white, you know.
Love Song also stars Rosanna Arquette as Mindy's estranged mother. Brooklyn Decker stars as a selfish maid of honor, while Ryan Eggold is Mindy's fiancé, Life. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States is determined to disrupt the illicit flow of money from the trade of oil and trafficking of antiquities to the terrorist group Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL. Toward this end, the U.S. Department of State's Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to the significant disruption of the sale and or trade of oil and antiquities by, for, on behalf of, or to benefit ISIL. Through its illegal oil operations and trafficking in looted archaeological material from Syria and Iraq, ISIL has generated millions of dollars in hard currency, enabling it to brutalize and oppress innocent civilians. This is the first time the U.S. Secretary of State has authorized a Rewards for Justice offer for information that could be used to disrupt the sale or trade in oil and antiquities by or on behalf of a terrorist organization. Anyone with information on oil and antiquities trafficking that benefits ISIL can contact the Rewards for Justice office via the website at www.rewardsforjustice.net or by email at info@rewardsforjustice.net or by standard mail at Rewards for Justice, Washington, D.C., 20520-0303, USA. Individuals in North America can also call this phone number, 1-800-877-3927. All information will be kept strictly confidential. The Rewards for Justice program is administered by the U.S. Department of State's Bureau of Diplomatic Security. Since its inception in 1984, the program has paid in excess of $125 million to more than 80 people who provided actionable information that put terrorists behind bars or prevented acts of international terrorism worldwide. Follow us on Twitter at https://twitter.com/rewardsforjustice, as in the numeral 4.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.